prolonged COVID-19 lockdowns have affected the drivers' income negatively so that they are unable to pay the lease of their vehicles. Therefore, working in these gardens has reduced their stress and provided the drivers and their families with food.
We here at IRIB English Radio express our heartfelt condolences to all our listeners on the occasion of 30th of Safar, the martyrdom anniversary of Imam Reza, peace be upon him, the 8th infallible successor to Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny. In the limelight.
UK businesses blame the pandemic and Brexit for the shortage of overseas workers, with 38% saying a lack of regional talent was hurting their ability to recruit much-needed staff. We now present you an article written by Kalina Markotov. The piece is titled, Survey Finds Staff Shortages Spreading to All Corners of UK Business. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. Survey has warned staff shortages are rippling out from the haulage, farming and hospitality sectors to almost all parts of the British economy, putting severe pressure on medium-sized businesses across the United Kingdom. More than a quarter of the 500 firms polled said the lack of staff was putting pressure on their ability to operate at normal levels, with reduced stock due to the resulting supply chain disruption hurting their business. While some firms had considered cutting production, others were planning to raise prices, leading to concerns over rising inflation as the Christmas trading period approaches. Nearly a fifth said they were increasing wages to attract new staff, while others were introducing extra perks to lure workers. But the report released by accountancy and advisory firm BDO said the knock-on effect for consumers could be significant, with nearly one-third of businesses saying the prices would need to rise in the next 3 to 6 months to keep up with the disruption. More than one-third of firms in the survey said they had also cut down on the kinds of products and services on offer, with a further third planned to do the same over the coming month unless the situation radically improves. A similar proportion expects stock ranges to be affected long term. Businesses blame the pandemic and Brexit for the shortage of overseas workers, with 38% saying a lack of regional talent was hurting their ability to recruit much-needed staff. BDO partner Ed Duan said, Brexit, global supply chain issues and the long tail of COVID-19 has created a perfect storm for British businesses. Ed Duan added, after navigating the challenges of the pandemic and hoping for some respite, Businesses have found themselves facing more major disruption, with those across almost all sectors reporting staff shortages. This is an era of upheaval and the challenges faced by the UK's mid-tier, the engine of the UK's economy, points to a long road ahead. The survey lays bare the challenges facing all tiers of British business. Heavy goods vehicle driver shortages have already resulted in fuel shortages across the country, while large companies such as Tesco warned recently that the labour crunch could lead to empty supermarket shelves and panic buying in the lead up to Christmas, unless the government relaxed immigration rules. Prime Minister Boris Johnson's government has since introduced emergency visas that will allow a potential 300 fuel drivers to arrive immediately and stay until the end of March, and let a potential 4,700 further food haulage drivers arrive from late October and leave by the end of February. Elsewhere, according to the latest business confidence survey from consultancy firm CGA and technology services firm Forth, the hospitality sector is also suffering from a lack of workers, with one in six jobs currently vacant. Only 18% of the 200 businesses in the restaurant and coffee shop industries said they were confident that they would be able to recruit and retain the staff needed to run their businesses. That is a dramatic drop from the 67% who felt secure about their talent prospect just 3 months ago. Around two-thirds said they expect to be hiring staff at a higher rate than usual this year, and were already struggling with absences, reporting that on average about 6% of staff were currently in isolation due to ongoing COVID risks. The shortage is forcing businesses to step up efforts to attract and keep hold of staff, with three-quarters saying they have offered better pay, while two-thirds have tried to cultivate the right working culture to retain workers. Bosses who have increased pay say they had hiked wages by up to 11% on average for current staff, and 13% for new hiring. The report said that higher wages, while pile extra costs on the hospitality sector, which was already facing rising food, drink, supply and utility costs. One of CGA's directors, Carl Chessel, said the figures illustrated the full scale of the hospitality sector's recruitment and retention crisis, and called for government support. Carl Chessel said thousands of businesses are now critically short of staff, while many of those who have sufficient labour face a fight to keep hold of it. He added, gaps at front and back of house and fast-rising wage costs threaten to derail the industry's recovery, and sustained targeted government support is now urgently needed to tackle the problem.
Has seen a countless number of events throughout centuries, including many wars and truces. But from the outset of the 21st century, something happened, something dramatic, that set off a chain of unnatural events.
Islam in Russia, Part 1.
after more than a decade, no one is really sure who actually set off what transpired. Many researchers are still studying its mysterious and contradictory details. But in the meantime, the finger has been pointed at a population a billion strong, with one thing in common: Islam. Yes, it was the Muslim community of the world that was blamed by the mainstream media for the September 11th tragedy and what ensued. But the strange thing is that in the first decade of the 21st century, Muslims were the main victims of wars and terrorist attacks. Take Afghanistan, Iraq, Palestine, Lebanon, Myanmar, Bahrain, and recently, in one of the most catastrophic of these complicated wars, Syria. But while Muslims are being accused of disrupting world order, history shows that wherever in the world they have lived, they have left relics of order and human civilization behind. And while Muslims are being massacred in the most horrendous ways in Syria, a huge country like Russia is one of their few allies. Russia's culture, art, science, and politics have made their mark on history with many famous names. Great writers and brilliant literary works like Pushkin, Dostoevsky, Tolstoy, Chekhov, Crime and Punishment, War and Peace, Tchaikovsky, Shostakovich, ballets and memorable operas, Eisenstein, Pudovkin, the glorious cinema of the 1920s, Yuri Gagarin, Man on the Moon, famous names of the fluctuant history of this country, from the Viking and Mughal eras to the Tsarist period, and contemporaries like Marx, Lenin, socialism, communism, and the dissolution of the Soviet Union. But there are things in Russia that the world knows less about. Residing in the neighborhood of the Russian Federation, even I didn't know that in a country I have always known for its great achievements of human civilization, lives more than 30 million native non-immigrant Muslims, whose ancestors have been living in this part of the world generation after generation for the last 1,300 years and played a crucial role in forming the history of the world's largest country. This is Russia, the largest country in the world. 17,075,400 square kilometers big. It includes all of Asia's north. And on the edge, between the east and the west, it joins Asia to Europe. The Russian Federation consists of 21 autonomous republics and two federal cities, Moscow and St. Petersburg. Here is the most southerly part of the Russian Federation, beside the Caspian Sea in the vicinity of Iran. The city is called Derbent. Derbent is located near Makhachkala, the capital of Dagestan. Historians suggest that this is the gate through which the religion Islam entered the territory, known today as the Russian Federation. Located between the Caspian Sea and the Monte Caucasus, the city of Derbent has been very important throughout history as the Caucasian territory's entrance. In the distant past, Derbent was seized by the powerful kings of the Sasanian Empire of Iran, and the city was named Derbent by the Sasanid king Khorvad. In Pahlavi Persian, Derbent means a narrow passage. There is an assumption that the people of Derbent were converted to Islam by the invitation of the Prophet's disciples who were fighting in the Arab army. When I went to visit the ancient graveyard of Derbent, I saw the tombs attributed to the Prophet's disciples. It seems these tombs were proof for those who assumed such, The assumption is that upon passing through the Sasanian Empire, the Arab Muslims arrived in the north of Iran, and thus Islam spread into the northern parts of the Sasanian Empire, Derbent of today. At that time, the Caspian people resided in this region. The Caspians were the most powerful state of Eastern Europe. The Friday Mosque is the oldest in Russia. With the Caspians converting to Islam and Muslims settling in the town of Derbent in the 8th century, the construction of seven mosques began. The last of these mosques was the Friday Mosque, that was built exclusively for Friday prayers. This mosque is more than 1,300 years old. In Russia, Islam was not limited to Derbent and the Caspian people. Islam had spread throughout Russia's entire southern regions. Then, in the 10th century, it reached the central regions of today's Russia. This is the city of Kazan, capital of the Republic of Tatarstan. Located between the Ural Mountains and the Volga River, Kazan is the city of mosques and churches. Muslims and Christians have been living here together for centuries. Today, in the vicinity of Kazan city, the remains of an ancient town are being kept as a museum. The city of Volga, Bulgaria, is on the banks of the Volga River. It has become a headquarters for a vast Islamic empire. Ibn Fazlan, an Arab explorer and travel writer, entered Volga, Bulgaria in 1922. Ibn Fazlan was the Muslims' caliphate envoy, and his mission was to present Islam to Amish, the king of Volga, Bulgaria. Before the arrival of Ibn Fazlan, the people of this region had already become familiar with Islam through their relations with Muslim merchants, so they readily accepted his message. Promoting Islam among other communities, the Bulgarians invited the mighty king of Kiev to accept Islam. History states Vladimir, who was looking for a religion for the Russians at the same time, asks the Bulgarian envoys about the traits of Islam. They answer that this is a religion that forbids eating pork and drinking alcohol. It's been said that for this reason, Vladimir does not accept Islam and answers, "Alcoholic drinks are cheerful for Russians and we can't live without them." In the end, Vladimir endorsed Christianity as the official religion of Russians in 988 AD. In 1237, Mughals and Tatars seized Volga, Bulgaria, and this state perished. Then the Golden Horde was established here. The Golden Horde was part of the Mughal Empire under the rule of Batu Khan, the grandchild of Genghis. The Golden Horde's kingdom consisted of the main parts of today's Russia, Kazakhstan, and Ukraine. It is unknown what the Golden Horde title refers to, but some sources state that Batu Khan had a large tent with golden pillars, and the Golden Horde was named after this tent. After the establishment of the Golden Horde, the Chengizian Code of Tolerance helped Muslims perform their religious duties with ease. After Uzbek Khan's accession and conversion to Islam, Islam became the official religion of the Golden Horde and began to spread quickly. The Islamic civilization circulated in the fields of southern Russia, and the cities of the Golden Horde were filled with clergymen, schools, and mosques. The golden age of the Golden Horde lasted 2 centuries. The Golden Horde's king's reputation for justice and their tolerance for other religions also spread to all Islamic states. But when Timur invaded the Bichar fields in the Golden Horde's kingdom and the ruins it had caused, the state was demolished and was broken down into different khanates. After Timur's army began marching on Moscow, the people of the city restored Kazan, and the Khanate of Kazan that earlier was part of the Golden Horde became an independent and powerful state. Kazan was the most affluent Khanate among the split regions of the Golden Horde, a state that had made significant economic and commercial advances in which the influences of the Islamic civilization were apparent. The Kazan city of today is in the territory of these modern Khanates. Kazan is a green and lively city on the banks of the fertile Volga River, and it has been one of the main settlements of the Muslims of Russia throughout history. Manifestations of the Muslim cultural heritage in this town are famous mosques like Bol Sharif, Marjani, and Apianevsky, all of which have a unique history and architecture. From the middle of the 15th century, with the rising of the dynasty of Russia, the Russian princes began their efforts for independence from Mongolian rule. Eventually, in 1480, Ivan III refused to accept the rule of the Mongols and wrenched back a vast part of Russia from Mongolian rule. A few years later, the Great Invasion took place. In the summer of 1552, an army of 150,000 men belonging to Ivan Grozny, historically known as Ivan the Terrible, invaded Kazan. The town was besieged by Russian aggressors. The October of that year coincided with Ramadan, the fasting month of the Muslims. Although they could have stayed alive by surrendering and giving them privileges, the Kazan defenders fought for Kazan until the last moment. Many Muslims were killed when the town was seized, including Sayyid Bol Sharif, the religious leader of the Tatars. Fighting for the resistance of Kazan until the last moment of his life, in the end he was thrown from the roof of his school by the Russian aggressors. Years later, in memory of Sayyid Bol Sharif's resistance, Russia's largest mosque was named after him. The Russians too, after massacring Muslims in Kazan and seizing their town, built the St. Vasily Church in Moscow in honor of their victory.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Ron DeSantis, the governor of Florida, has outlawed mask requirements in the state and threatened to withhold the salaries of superintendents and county school board members who issue them for students. As infections soar among children, Some of the state's biggest school districts vowed to flout the governor's order. We now present you an article written by David Smith. The piece is titled, U.S. Republican Leaders Fiddle While COVID Burns Through Their Own Supporters. The article has been published by the British newspaper The Guardian. The crowd gathered under a tent at the water's edge, their tables decorated with the stars and stripes and checked tablecloths. In their midst in Austin County, Texas, last Saturday, 7th of August, was the state's governor, Greg Abbott, laughing with delight and playing the fiddle. With the coronavirus roaring through the state and hospitals near breaking point, comparisons with Nero fiddling while Rome burnt were irresistible, although journalist Alicia Grusso pointed out on Twitter, Nero actually enacted sweeping relief effort to try to quell the fire and also offer his people aid in the aftermath, particularly the lower class. So Abbott is somehow worse than a Roman emperor known today as being a psychotic tyrant. But Governor Greg Abbott, who has banned mask requirements, is far from an outlier in a Republican Party which, having long sought to downplay the climate crisis, is now offering a confusing, incoherent, and anti-scientific response to the biggest public health crisis for a century. Some Republican leaders are seeking to support Joe Biden's efforts to beat the pandemic by encouraging the public to get vaccinated as soon as possible. But others are actively trying to undermine the president's offensive by embracing what critics regard as a lethal mix of ignorance, irrationality, and nihilism. These Republicans seem intent on scoring political points by appealing to a pandemic-weary public's yearning to get back to something like normal life. Still enthralled to former President Donald Trump, they fiercely oppose wearing face masks or vaccine mandates by invoking traditional party tenets of individual freedom, personal responsibility, and resisting state interference. With America now averaging about 113,000 cases a day, an increase of nearly 24% from the previous week, and hospitalizations up by 31% from the week before, Republicans stand accused of causing the deaths of their own voters, as the highly contagious Delta variant of the coronavirus skies through red states where vaccination rates are low. Elaine Kamark, a Democrat who served in the Bill Clinton administration, said bluntly, "They've gone out of their minds. That's just no other way to describe this. This is about the dumbest thing you could imagine, because the only people listening to them are their own voters. So this is the first time I've ever seen a political party advocating things that would harm their voters, maybe even kill their own voters." For 6 months, the vaccine program was an example of American ingenuity, energy, and can-do spirit. But more recently, it has become a yet another case study in the self-inflicted wounds of polarization, reviving a sense of anxiety, uncertainty, and pessimism. In the past week, Florida and Texas, states whose leaders take pride in riding the Biden administration, have accounted for nearly 40% of new hospitalizations across the country. Governor Greg Abbott banned mask mandates, yet pledged to bring extra healthcare workers from out of state and ask hospitals to postpone elective surgeries. The Austin and Dallas independent school districts have said they will defy Governor Greg Abbott's ban and require wearing face masks in schools. Ron DeSantis, the governor of Florida, has also outlawed mask requirements in the state and threatened to withhold the salaries of superintendents and county school board members who issue them for students. As infections soar among children, some of the state's biggest school districts have vowed to flout the governor's order. Chrissy Noem, the governor of South Dakota, welcomed hundreds of thousands of people to the Sturgis motorcycle rally, where no face masks or vaccines are required, while Henry McMaster, the governor of South Carolina, declared, "Mandating masks is not the answer. Personal responsibility is the answer. Common sense is the answer. And we have an abundance of both in South Carolina." At the White House on Thursday, 12th of August, Joe Biden expressed frustration with governors prolonging the pandemic. He said, "I know there are a lot of people out there trying to turn a public safety measure, that is, children wearing masks in school so they can be safe, into a political dispute." He added, "And this isn't about politics, this is about keeping our children safe." Critics say the governors have abandoned the conservative principle that decisions should be made at a local level, but they have support from prominent Republican senators such as Ted Cruz of Texas and Rand Paul of Kentucky. Rand Paul, a licensed physician and senator from Kentucky, urged civil disobedience against coronavirus restrictions, saying in a video, "It's time for us to resist. They can't arrest all of us." He has been banned from YouTube for a week over a post that questioned the efficacy of wearing face masks. President Biden's efforts is also being undercut by prominent conservative media figures, including the Fox News hosts Tucker Carlson and Laura Ingraham, who have challenged the safety and questioned the effectiveness of the vaccine, as well as online conspiracy theories that falsely suggest that it harms fertility, contains microchips, or even creates vampires. Democrats are dismayed by such willingness to turn even a matter of life and death into a partisan issue. They note that a minority of the population is hampering the entire nation's recovery and needlessly endangering more lives, including the lives of children. Bob Shrum, a Democratic strategist, said, "They share a profound irresponsibility. What they're doing will sicken people and some people will die. In my view, Ron DeSantis and Greg Abbott are both doing it for political purposes to satisfy their base. DeSantis, at least, is too smart to not know what he's doing or not know what he should be doing, but that's what we've come to in this country." The resurgent pandemic has also exposed fault lines in the Trump-era Republican Party, a contradiction embodied by the former president himself. Donald Trump continues to trumpet his success in developing the vaccines and quietly received one in January, yet often seems reluctant to encourage his supporters to follow suit. Mitch McConnell, the Senate minority leader frequently at odds with Donald Trump, has paid for advertisements in Kentucky, urging his constituents to get vaccinated, citing his own childhood struggle with polio and the decades it took to develop a polio vaccine. Kay Ivey, the governor of Alabama, has spoken out about her frustrations with the unvaccinated. She said recently, "Folks supposed to have common sense, but it's time to start blaming the unvaccinated folks, not the regular folks." She added, "It's the unvaccinated folks that are letting us down." Asa Hutchinson, the governor of Arkansas, has admitted that he regretted signing a ban on mask mandates in schools and asked the state legislature to reverse the decision. He said, "I signed it for those reasons that our cases were at a low point." He added, "Everything has changed now, and yes, in hindsight, I wish that it had not become law." Sarah Sanders, a former White House press secretary who's running for Arkansas governor, published an opinion column about why she decided to get vaccinated, citing Donald Trump and his family's own shots as one reason. "If getting vaccinated was safe enough for them, I felt it was safe enough for me. But stop short of telling others to do likewise, advising, pray about it, discuss it with your family and your doctor." Ron DeSantis and Greg Abbott are both facing re-election contests in 2022. and seen as potential presidential contenders in 2024, which might help explain why their responses are targeted at a Trump base, while Asa Hutchinson and Kay Ivey are more pragmatic. Other Republicans have an eye on next year's congressional midterm elections, which they hope to turn into a protest vote against Joe Biden. Joe Walsh, a former Republican congressman turned Trump critic and radio host, says, "It's where their votes are. I interact with the Republican base every day. They're still highly skeptical or resistant to vaccines. They're up in arms against any sort of wearing face masks and mask mandates. So I hear that every day from the base. If I'm hearing that, then you know these Republican office holders are hearing that as well. So they're just going to cater to that." Asked why voters feel this way, Joe Walsh said, "They're predisposed to believe a lot of this, but it's also said to them every day by people like Tucker Carlson and Laura Ingraham and talk radio, the world I come from. Like Republicans, elected officials, they know where their audience is, so they feel this every day and they feel it every day, so they bounce back off each other." Joe Walsh noted, "Look, typically midterm elections are all about turnout, and if Republican elected officials go squishy on wearing face masks and even vaccines, people are not going to come out and vote, so they can't do that." But Michael Steele, a former chairman of the Republican National Committee, argues that such a strategy will prove counterproductive in the long term. Michael Steele said, "Never before in history of our country, where we've had to confront national crises, have elected officials behave so badly, so disingenuously, and with so much disregard for the safety and security of the American people."
Discovering Islam.
After birth, death is the greatest event in every person's life. It is the most private experience of every individual that cannot be shared with anyone else. Their death is followed by the destruction of the body as we know. However, would that mean the total destruction of the person? Why do we die at all? What is the philosophy of our temporary life on this earth? Why is death so scary for many people? Is the dichotomy of soul and body true? And if that is the case, what is the soul and how would it leave the body? If there is one thing that we can be certain of, it's that we will die. Yet death remains one of the greatest mysteries that man has ever known.
There is a definition of death which doctors give us, which is when the brain waves or the electrical waves in the brain stop. That would be counted as death.
Scientifically, death is the cessation of all biological functions that maintain a person. Roughly 150,000 people die around the world each day, so it should be one of the most familiar subjects for all. Most people wish that they never have to think about it or face death, and they're even scared to think about it.
If you ask someone to enter a room and no one would be able to leave that room and come back and give you an experience of how it felt to go into that room, many people would hesitate to enter that room. In the same way, when it comes to death, many people who have died and none of them have returned back to life to give us or share with us how they experienced that death or where did they go. So it's a transition to, for us in this world, and for many, somewhere unknown.
The word death conjures up an idea of the end of things. When we use death in English, we say when something dies, it seems to us almost to mean that it is now useless. It can be discarded. It has no value. It has lost its vitality. But it's not a very good word, or it hasn't taken a very good meaning in that way, because in Islam, death is a transference, according to many hadiths, from one abode to another abode. It is like walking through a doorway. If you call a doorway death, fine. It certainly is not an end to life. It is a continuation to life.
You know, we can understand why people find it uncomfortable to talk about death. And one of the reasons is because of the intense love we have for the world. And death signifies a departure from these attractive, beautiful things of the world.
All cultures correspond death with frightening thoughts and images. The reason for that is because we look at it from the departure side, because we are scared to leave what we are very much familiar with to the unknown. However, if we were to see it as an arrival, we find it to be more of a blessing than a loss.
It's a shedding of clothes. It's taking, I don't know, you can say a shower and cleaning the filth from your body. So in other words, it's an existential thing. It's not absence of something. Unlike what we are brought up being taught, or directly or indirectly, about how death is absence of life. No, life, as we know it, is something that has different stages in Islam. So it's not that we have life and then death. Life continues. We just have to shift. We have to cross the bridge. Imam Hussein alayhi salam on Ashura, he would tell his companions that be patient. Death is nothing but a bridge where you're crossing to go to the better stuff, to higher levels of existence and life actually.
We are born for eternity, and death, unfortunately, is taken negatively as if it means the end. The Islamic explanation is that death is just a transfer. It's a gateway to enter the second, or the stage after this current stage. Stage one is this life. Stage two is transition between this life and the afterlife, the barzakh. Stage three, eternity.
What's important to realize is it's all like what we call the circle of life. There was the side of the human being descending from the higher up to dunya. And that's why dunya is called dunya, because it's at the bottom of the cycle. Okay. And then it will start to ascend back again to where it came from, and that's when the soul is separated from the body and the nafs goes back. Inna lillah wa inna ilayhi raji'un.
Yeah, Islam's picture of life and death is part of a broader process, part of a bigger process. It is simply a gateway into that which is to come.
Death is really the bridge that unites the lover with his beloved, meaning that, you know, man who loved his Lord, he now wants to meet his beloved, his creator.
Man is a traveling creature. He starts from a drop to a clinging mass, to a fleshy tissue, to a fetus, to a baby, to a child, to a youth, to an adult, to an elderly, and eventually to the grave. But is the journey going to stop here? Is this the end, or there are other stations to this uninterrupted journey?
We have a verse in the Quran, يَا أَيُّهَا الْإِنسَانِ إِنَّكَ كَادِحٌ إِلَىٰ رَبِّكَ كَدْحًا فَمُلَاقِيهِ. oh man, you're moving towards your Lord, you're traversing a path towards your Lord, and you will eventually meet him. This shows that we're on a journey, and life is a journey, and it ends with meeting our Lord. Does this journey end with death? The answer to this is that if we look at what the definition was in the beginning of life, then we will understand that life doesn't end with death. And since life doesn't end with death and is continuous, then so the journey continues as well.
The baby's journey to the world is full of wonders, and the elderly travels to the grave is even more wondrous. Now, based on Islamic teachings, death is ripeness of the soul and its readiness to be picked and initiated into the wonders of a new life. It is the tunnel to a phenomenal world of wonders.
The death, as we know it, is not an end to life. Rather, it is a portal, a doorway into a new and more expansive existence. And indeed, as we move on in this journey from this dunya into barzakh and then later on to the day of judgment, we are constantly evolving and changing. We're not dying.
But where is the destination of this journey? How many more stations are out there? Where is the map for this long travel?
We're here for eternity. We're born for eternity, not for death. Yes, since death is going to take us closer to that eternity, then in a sense you can say we're born to die. But not we're born to die in the sense that we are born for absence of life. No, we are born so that eventually we will be transmitted from one level of existence in life to the next level of existence in life to eventually attain that eternity we were born for.
Some say there is no afterlife, but they only assume. And why should we follow their assumption? Why should we think that this journey should stop so abruptly? Why should man, this traveling creature, stop traveling? If he were to stop, why did he set out? Why shouldn't we follow those who claim knowledge of that side and listen to those who only assume?
Somebody recently sent me a picture of twins in the womb of mother. One of them arguing that there is no life after birth, another saying there is life after birth. So in the similar way, we are in this world. Those who believe, they are arguing there is no life after this world, and others say there is life after this world.
I believe there is an afterlife, but I believe it cannot be objectively proven. It is something which you need to go inward through introspection, through interaction with Allah, seeing the signs in your life. I believe the afterlife can be discerned from this life itself.
We started from that drop of water, and we are where we are now. However, for the final destination, we need more progress. The Quran gives us some preview of what we may expect in our progress into future. We have to be prepared for that great encounter, meeting with the Lord, the Creator. He wants to share with us what he has. وَبَشِّرِ الْمُؤْمِنِينَ بِأَنَّ لَهُمْ مِنَ اللَّهِ فَضْلًا كَبِيرًا. He loves that you live beside him, pure and honest. فِي مَقْعَدِ صِدْقٍ عِنْدَ مَلِيكٍ مُقْتَدِرٍ. He's waiting to meet you and to live with you forever. خَالِدِينَ فِيهَا نُزُلًا مِنْ عِنْدِ اللَّهِ.
Death is an astonishing path through the world of wonders. Some people have had flavors of that adventurous dimension on many instances of near-death experience.
Near-death experience is a personal, involuntary experience in which the person will see its oneself outside the body, and while in a condition of a crisis, like an accident or a surgery, and the person will be considered clinically dead, but then eventually the person will come back. And in the case of the near-death experience, the person will have a recollection of what happened during this period in which he or she was completely considered dead.
In his book, Life After Life, The Investigation of a Phenomenon, Survival of Body Death, the American psychologist and medical doctor Raymond Moody has compiled huge data and presented extensive analysis on near-death experience. He's classified the experience of 150 patients with near-death experiences into several categories. Now, one group experienced that they left their bodies while they were absolutely conscious and could observe the efforts of the medical team. Another group felt that they were okay in a body different from their physical body. Now, Moody uses the term spiritual body for this.
In the case of the near-death experience, it happens when the person is close to death, or when this person is actually considered dead, which means no heartbeat, no brain activity whatsoever. So in this case, what happens is that the person will experience different things that we cannot see here, and the person will normally have some characteristics. For example, the person will hear sometimes noises that we call it intracranial sounds. It just happens inside of their heads. Then normally they see a tunnel. Many times they see a light at the end of the tunnel. So they float, or sometimes they just go quickly towards the light.
Other experiences implied losing the sense of physical time, peace and tranquility, confusion as a consequence of leaving the physical body. Another group reported that they saw a prominent religious personality in a body made of light.
Some others stated that initially they did not realize they were in a new body until they found out that the hearing and their vision of their relatives was too weak to see or hear them, although their own senses had intensified so that they could hear and see new things.
What these studies tell us is that firstly, our knowledge about human being is much less than what we assume. And secondly, we have to confess that our current scientific tools are inadequate for these novel areas of research. And finally, and most importantly, not everyone has the same experience of death.
يَعْلَمُونَ ظَاهِرًا مِنْ حَيَاةِ الدُّنْيَا, the Quran says. People appreciate only very surface aspects of the creation. وَهُمْ بِالْآخِرَةِ هُمْ غَافِلُونَ. And they're oblivious of the expansive nature of what I have really created.
Generally, death is an experience similar to the birth of a baby, where it travels from one world to another. The difference, however, is that the baby cannot remember anything from its previous world, while the baby's soul is extremely astute and can feel the difference. By entering into that realm, the soul moves one step closer to its completion, and its power to comprehend the realities of existence would increase. Hence, it is now one stage nearer to the final destination, meeting with the Lord. A meeting which is not like meeting of a person with another person, but meeting of two worlds.
The whole purpose of this worldly life, this transient, ephemeral and fleeting 70 or 80 years, is that we prepare our souls, we make them ready and fit for the divine proximity and divine neighborhood, so that we become the neighbors of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. We become fit to have that beatific vision in paradise.
The soul is very difficult to define, but in a simple expression, It is what we call I, the one who wills, who decides, who judges, who loves and hates, the one who uses the body as a means towards its end. We usually think that these are functions of the mind, while the mind is a simple conglomeration of absolutely separate cells.
We have to see what defines that person. Is it the body, or is it the me within the body? When we're growing up as kids, we have that me in us. As we grow older, we feel that this same me that I had when I was a kid is still that same me. Of course, experiences are added to me, but the me is the same me. We can't fool ourselves. As we grow older and older, the same me again and again. So, does the person die? We have to see. The body will die for sure. The body is destroyed for sure. But the person, no. The person will live on. That me, or in other words, the soul, is going to live on.
Meccans asked the Prophet, tell us what the ruh is. What is the spirit? He said, يَسْأَلُونَكَ عَنِ الرُّوحِ قُلِ الرُّوحُ مِنْ أَمْرِ رَبِّي. They ask you about the soul, what it is. Tell them that the soul is my Lord's command. And that's all you can understand. You can't understand more than that. And of course, you know, when I say you can't understand more than that, you know, some people will say, well, we live in a very enlightened age of science and technology and information, and we have everything on our fingertips. But let me tell you, you know, the best minds in physics, the best minds in biochemistry, the best minds in genetics, best minds in technology and engineering, and in every field will say to you, we only know this much. We only know this much of the physical world.
It is true that the soul knows this world by the help of body and its different organs. And if it was not for the body, the soul would have not known anything. It is as the Quran mentions, وَاللَّهُ أَخْرَجَكُمْ مِنْ بُطُونِ أُمَّهَاتِكُمْ لَا تَعْلَمُونَ شَيْئًا وَجَعَلَ لَكُمُ السَّمْعَ وَالْأَبْصَارَ وَالْأَفْئِدَةَ لَعَلَّكُمْ تَشْكُرُونَ. God has brought you forth from the wombs of your mothers while you did not know anything. He made for you hearing, eyesight and hearts so that you may appreciate. Mutually, if it was not for the soul, the body would not have been able to do anything. Death happens when the soul leaves the body. The question is, what would the soul do without the body, which was its only means to every end? The answer is that it lives in another body.
When you die, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala puts your soul in another body. Now, let's say it like this. You have a body once you die as well. And you will eat, you will drink, and so on. Or you will be punished to an extent. And this is called the mithali body, they call it. Which means that you have that same shape and form, but you don't have material anymore. Okay, so you have height, width, maybe length, but you don't have that material. Okay, it's not something tangible, and that's why we, in this realm of life, we can't see those who have passed away.
The soul is the real us. The body is a vehicle. That's why when, for example, we look in the mirror and we say, I, we don't mean this body with its limbs. If we were to lose a hand tomorrow and look in the mirror, we'll still say I and mean the same thing. We won't say I less five fingers. So we have an understanding of the real us, who we refer to as I. This soul requires, depending on which environment it is in, a body of sorts. And there will be a more subtle body that it occupies as it moves on into barzakh, and an even more subtle body that it occupies when it moves into the Day of Judgment.
That is really a move from one realm of existence into another. It is moving from the physical world, the material world, the touchable world, the tangible world, into the realm of spirit, the realm that is spiritual, the realm that is beyond and above the laws of physics, really. Gravitation or material or physical things actually don't exist in that world. It's a world of its own, with its own laws and with its own
that spiritualistic communication or spiritualistic sense is simply that sense which is not materialistic, the sense which is got that